Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Today we're going to, well, we got the 10,000 hour rule up, Malcolm Gladwell, but I wanted to open it up if you guys wanted to talk about it. If any of you are following the Kyle, well, what's this dude's name? Let me get his name right. The Kyle Rittenhouse case up in Wisconsin. Wanted to get you guys' thoughts on that, if you got any at all. But Kyle Rittenhouse, he's got a trial that's going on right now up in Kenosha. Well, it happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin. But if after I play Faith Street, if any guys want to chime in on that one, I think it's a pretty interesting case.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Okay. We want to go over the 10,000-hour rule today to get some momentum going for 2022. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, anybody out there following the Kyle Rittenhouse case, up, I believe it's in Wisconsin. Let me read about it. Okay. No, I don't want that page. Kyle Rittenhouse, and let me get it directly. Okay, on August 25th, 2020, amid the unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, after the police shooting of Jacob Blake, Kyle Rittenhouse, at the time a 17-year-old from Antioch, Illinois, shot and killed two men and wounded another in the arm during a confrontation at two locations. He was armed with an AR, which means assault rifle, 15-style rifle, and the individual wounded by Rittenhouse was armed with a handgun. Rittenhouse had said that he was there to protect a car dealership from being vandalized and to provide medical aid and was carrying a med kit. Now, the first thing that comes to my mind is, number one, he's 17 at the time. Number two, he said he was there to protect the car dealership. So number two is, was he a licensed armed security guard? That's the next question. And number three, he was also there to provide medical aid and was carrying a med kit. Third question I have is, was he a trained medical, and if you need a license, medical professional? Those are three questions I have. I don't know at this point. All right. At the first location, Rittenhouse was pursued by a group including Kenosha resident Joseph Rosenbaum. A gunshot was fired into the air by a third party, and according to a witness, an unarmed Rosenbaum lunged at Rittenhouse and attempted to take his rifle. Rittenhouse then fired four times at Rosenbaum, who died shortly afterwards. The second location, Rittenhouse tripped while fleeing and a man kicked him. Rittenhouse fired at the man twice but missed. Protesters approached Rittenhouse while he was still on the ground, and a Silver Lake resident, Anthony Huber, struck Rittenhouse with a skateboard and struggled for control of his rifle. Rittenhouse then fired at Huber once, killing him. Now, that's two people that this 17-year-old at the time has killed. Mind you, Rittenhouse at the time was just a normal citizen. West Allis resident George Grossenroots then approached Rittenhouse carrying a handgun. Rittenhouse shot him once, severing his right, Jesus, man, his right bicep. Damn, that's a hell of a visual on that. And that's just with your imagination. Rittenhouse was arrested and charged with multiple counts of homicide and unlawful possession of a firearm, and a 19-year-old man was arrested and charged with unlawfully supplying Rittenhouse's rifle. Rittenhouse's attorney says he acted in self-defense upon hearing firearm discharge, and in response to the physical confrontations of his protesters, public sentiment, and the media coverage of the shootings was polarized. The trial for Rittenhouse began on November 1st, 2021 in Kenosha, Wisconsin. You guys, any thoughts on that? Kyle Rittenhouse, and they're running the trial on YouTube live on a daily. He shot two people dead. Now, his whole thing is he was going up there. to help the police. Let's see. Anything else? I don't know, just my take on it. I think he will be, you know, I don't know what he's, I got to find out what he's charged with. Well, his thing is self-defense at the moment. In any event, if you guys got any comment on the Rittenhouse case, 619-768-2945, let's get to the 10,000-hour rule.
Repetition. Repetition, guys. This is what I want to talk to you about this morning. It is crazy to me that me, I'm being asked to consult for companies. Like most of the companies that ask me to consult for them, you know what they want from me? They want me to use my gift of teaching and explaining their product. Usually it's like, okay, for instance, as a physical therapist, for those of you that, a few of you in the group have been a patient of mine, my strength is my ability to educate, right? That is my strength. And I can give you your condition that you have, and I can actually make you understand it for the first time in your life. So I do that for disc problems, neck problems, hip problems, hamstring problems. I have this gift of explaining things to people so that they actually understand it. And that's what companies mostly want me to consult and do for them. So Blue Jay Medical, 3D4 Medical. 3D4 Medical is the highest rated medical app in all of iTunes. And I am their physical therapist consultant for them. And I've been their PT consultant for them since 2008. Okay? So here's the deal. This is why this is so important. This is so important because I struggle with the speech impediment. I struggle with stuttering. I've struggled with stuttering all of my life. I nearly did not become a physical therapist because of my stuttering problems. And how I've been able to overcome those stuttering problems, dealing with people every single day, is because of reps. It's repetition. It's doing something over and over and over and over again until you get to the point where you have what I call unconscious competence. Meaning that, you know how like sometimes you're driving, like you're driving and you're on the highway and you're like, wait, how the hell did I just get over here when I was just over there? Like, how did I just do that? That's because you are so proficient at driving that sometimes you don't even have to be totally conscious and aware of what you're doing, and you're so good at it that you can like get from point A to point B and not even remember how that happened. Well, that's called conscious competence. Okay, so I'm not going to get into all of it right now, but if you want to be good at something that you currently aren't good at, you have to do so many reps. Many of you are in this group, you guys have been doing this program, or you're onto another program, you might be on a 22-minute hardcore or whatever. But at some point when you first started, you remember how hard it was to get started? Remember how difficult it was to do a burpee, or how difficult it was to push out reps when you're doing chest press or do bear crawls, which some of you are doing right now? How difficult it was? But how comes it over time it does get a little bit easier? It's because of reps. Guys, whatever you want to do in life, you have to rep it out. You're going to have to just constantly do it until your body just becomes proficient with it. Take it from me. Stuttering Greg, that is now known as an educator and a speaker. It gets crazy. It's crazy. But you know what? It's the truth. If you guys want to get good at something, do it consistently over and over and over again. And don't stop until you get good at it. And then when you get good at it, do more. so you can get better and better and better.
Malcolm Gladwell is here. He is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. His first two books, The Tipping Point and Blink, each sold well over 2 million copies in the United States. His unique take on the world ultimately has even spawned its own term, Gladwellian. His new book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. I am very pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now tell me, I said to you as you sat down, I am fascinated by performance and success, and success in terms of the essence of it. And how do you get there? Not that there's a magic formula, you know, but what can we understand about it?
Yeah. No, it is. It's this sort of perennially interesting question, and there are so many different answers depending on who you ask and when you ask them, and that's why we keep returning to it. If it was some little simple algorithm we could apply, it wouldn't capture our imagination in the same way.
It is said that part of the reason for this book, and there is some personal biography here, you talk about your grandmother, was that you were in search of explaining your own success, this phenomenal success you've had.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was a conscious attempt. I would never do something so explicitly autobiographically, consciously. But I suppose on some level, I mean, that question began to occur to me because my own success doesn't seem to me to be entirely rational, or it certainly wasn't anything I would have expected.
And you couldn't necessarily look at particular biographical points and say, aha, this guy is going to be either president or write bestsellers.
Yeah, it seemed that I got really lucky. I mean, luck is a huge theme in this book. And it's funny, and you know, we're not very good with luck. We tend to sort of discount it. We'd always rather give a kind of considered explanation for something than just to say it's happenstance. But you know what? A lot of the time it really is. And I try and sort of zero in on what is exactly the nature of the lucky break that characterizes so much of truly outstanding success.
Okay, let's take an easy example that you use. Mm-hmm. Bill Gates.
Yeah, so Bill Gates is lucky in many ways.
Yeah, very bright.
He starts two ways in particular. One is that when he walks into eighth grade at Lakeside Academy in Seattle in 1968, there is a computer terminal sitting there with a link into a mainframe in downtown Seattle. No one had access to a computer terminal in eighth grade or ninth grade or tenth grade or even college in 1968.
Anywhere else in the world.
No, and he himself told me, he's like, if there were 50 people in my position in 1968, I'd be stunned. And he basically spends his entire teenage years programming, right? Because of this gift. And he would tell me one point, Paul Allen, his great high school buddy, with whom he co-founds Microsoft, discovers there's a mainframe down at University of Washington that's free, it's not being used, between 2 and 6 in the morning. So he goes to bed at 10 o'clock, sets the alarm clock, climbs out the window, whatever, at 1:30 in the morning, walks 2 miles to the University of Washington, and programs from 2 till 6. Now, I love that story because it's the two parts of his success are right there. One is the extraordinary desire and obsessiveness and determination and love of computing, but the other is the fact that he's a guy who lives 2 miles from a mainframe in 1973 that's free between 2 and 6 in the morning, right? Now, lots of people may have the first thing. Almost no one has the second thing, right? I could have walked for a month and not come on to a mainframe.
Right, but this is central to what you were saying here, and so let's explore it in more. The Beatles.
Yeah. Same thing. So Beatles, I mean, I'm really interested in one of the other themes I come back to in the book is this notion of how long does it take to be good at something?
Exactly.
And psychologists who have looked at this in the expertise literature have said, you know what, if you look at a whole range of cognitively complex activities, time and time again we see that expertise is reached only after a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice. And that roughly translates to 10 years of doing something. And I do this actually now with anyone who's good at something. I could do it with you right now. I just ask people, all right, in your career, what was the point that you started to feel comfortable in your role? And it's always 10 years. And I'm sure if we did the math with you right now, it would come out to...
No, you're right, you're right, you're right.
And yeah. so this magic number of 10,000 hours, what that says is the first in a cohort to reach 10,000 hours has a huge advantage. Mm. So Gates having that computer down the street, or that computer in eighth grade, gives him his 10,000 hours before anyone else who was that age. The Beatles, before they come to America, get invited to go to Hamburg. They're still teenagers, and they become a house band in a strip club, and they play eight-hour sets 7 days a week for months at a time. They get their 10,000 hours in before the British invasion, right? That's why they're good. I mean, it's not the only reason, but absent that kind of intensive grad school in rock and roll, they're not the band that we think they are, and they don't make that splash when they come to America.
And I assume that you could look at people who have been great athletes where there's a demand for poems at a young age,
yeah,
and discover that they started practicing under very good circumstances very early. Tiger Woods would be Exhibit 1.
Would be Exhibit 1. And the key, what you just said is key, what you said under very good circumstances. This is not just Michael Jordan going out and shooting baskets. The term that expertise researchers use is deliberate practice. That is to say, focused, intensive practice with an eye to zeroing in on your failures and addressing them, your weaknesses. And I'm sure, you know, I would love to have a camera on Michael Jordan as a 16-year-old as he plays basketball and seeing, because I am convinced that that's what sets him apart, that when he practiced in a different way. And that he was constantly thinking about what am I not doing well and why am I not doing it well and what can I do to perfect it.
Because, you know, he didn't make his team as a 14-year-old or something.
Oh, yeah.
The junior
yeah.
high team didn't make it and then became a star and got a scholarship to University of North Carolina.
What's interesting, just to talk about Michael Jordan for a second, you know, unlike a lot of other basketball players, his game changes dramatically over the course of his professional career. And he's not a great outside shooter when he starts and has a, you know, devastating jump shot by the time he retires. So he never stopped this kind of constant process.
You know, he added to his arsenal once he became a pro, even. You know, there have been lots of examples of that. People that had a certain kind of college career, and then they found out once they got to be a pro that they needed to add to it. But what do we read into this? We read in this access to deliberate practice over 10,000 times.
Yes.
May give you the opportunity for success.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a big thing because, you know, ultimately this book ends up with a series of kind of policy prescriptions because it's supposed to be a way of thinking about this question of how do we help people achieve their potential, right? And there's all kinds of ways to do that. And the very simple answer from the book is you give them opportunities to work harder. And so I end the book, for example, with a chapter about the KIPP academies in this new breed of charter schools, which is really based on this idea. There's nothing fancy about what they do. What they do is extend the school day, extend the school year into the summer, have school start at 7 and go until 6 at night, and have them come in on Saturday. And for kids who want to work harder, they will give you that opportunity. And the insight is that kids who want to work hard can't work hard unless it's a school there to do it.
That's true, too. But, I mean, what separates the kids who want to work hard from those that don't?
One of the chapters in the book is about Jewish lawyers.
Yes, right? Exactly. It's wonderful.
And it's all about this group of men who rise from the Bronx in Brooklyn, children of immigrants from Europe, grew up, parents in the garment industry, grew up in the tenements.
Right, in the 1930s.
In the 30s and 40s, and end up at the top of the legal profession in New York. This is hunger, right?
Right.
So, and one of the central ideas in that chapter is this notion that it was because they were discriminated against as Jews coming out of law school, and as a result, forbidden to work at the big downtown law firms, that they went out on their own and took up this unfashionable area of corporate law called takeovers, and practiced it in isolation and obscurity for 20 years, and then
all of a sudden it became a big deal.
Big deal, and they were at the top of the game.
And they were prepared. Preparation meets opportunity.
That slight, though, at the beginning, the big fancy WASPI law firm telling these kids named, you know, Greenberg or Flom or what have you, that you can't work here.
And we don't care what your grades were at Harvard.
And we don't care what you, or in their case, NYU.
Yeah, right.
But, well, yeah, we don't care. That, you know, that slight is of incalculable importance. I mean, you just said that Jordan doesn't make his team in the
when he's 14.
When he's 14, right? Again, that slight is that. I think that is the kind of added psychological.
But do you have that gene in you?
Did I have it? I don't think I've ever had a slight, but I'm not.
Not a slight. I mean, I don't think it has to be born of a slight.
No,
I mean,
no.
I think it can come from, and that's the intriguing question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just saw Rolling Stone. I mean, yeah, Rolling Stone has got a list of the 25 greatest singers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And including John Lennon.
Yeah.
Now, talent had something to do with this.
Yes. Yeah.
So where do we put that?
You know, obviously it's there. What's fascinating to me is in the psychological literature on expertise, there are a whole group of psychologists for whom I have an infinite amount of respect who will stand up and with a straight face say that talent doesn't exist, that it's all application and effort. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, but what that tells me is, look, we think it's this much, and it's not. It's this much, you know, it's some tiny fraction of what we think it is.
I believe that because I'm being fascinated by the subject of talent and performance and what makes people the way they are. I have, in the history of doing this, more than 30 years, 30 years, this show, 18 years, I have never had somebody say to me, you know, the reason I'm so good at what I do is because I'm smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
It is all because I wanted it more, I worked harder, I focused more, I sacrificed more, and, more importantly, I had a deep passion for the thing.
Yeah.
Whether it was swinging a golf ball, hitting a basketball, doing scientific research, being a diplomat.
Yeah.
And they never lose it.
Yeah.
And it is their best friend, their very best friend. Everything else takes, you know, and then you get into work balance and all that stuff. Am I right?
Yeah. No, you know, when I think about the story of the Beatles, what's fascinating about them, of course, is that they went to Hamburg in the 50s and were a house band for a strip club. Do we have any idea how miserable that must have been? 8-hour sets. You must really, truly love rock and roll if you're willing to play as a house band in a Hamburgian strip club.
Exactly,
I mean, it's like the nastiest situation.
Yeah. You're willing to take the sacrifices necessary to get there.
Yeah.
So what do we know about Barack Obama? I mean, here's a man who's had phenomenal success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's at the epitome of power in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts of Barack Obama that fascinate me. You know, the second half of my book is all about culture,
right,
but the role that culture plays in success, and how different cultures have very, very different strengths and different. And so I spend a lot of time contrasting Asian and Western cultures, for example, and talking about how Asians kids are better at mathematics for cultural reasons, that there's something about their culture that's beautifully suited to the
test. This is intriguing, though. I mean, it tells what it has to do with.
Well, I think it has to do. So we make this observation that there's a huge difference in the performance of Asian kids and Western kids on math tests, right? And we know it's not. We've refuted the genetic argument. They're not genetically better at it. And we also know that from a series of psychological tests that they work harder, and that's the key. They're just simply willing to persevere more. The application of effort is greater. So why? And I have this whole chapter, which is I think it has to do with patterns of agricultural practice going back hundreds, if not thousands.
Having to do with rice.
Rice. My father's European peasant ancestors, who were, you know, in the wheat fields of northern England, probably worked 1,000 hours a year and had lots of holidays and were drunk most of the winter and sleeping and worked till noon every day, right? Their Chinese counterparts in that same period were working 3,000 hours a year, weren't drinking out off the afternoons, and weren't sleeping through the winter. They were putting in a second crop of rice. Rice cultures are renowned for the fact that rice is infinitely more labor-intensive than traditional Western agriculture. And I think that if a culture engages in that kind of intensive work for 1,500 years, it doesn't go away. And so you take that child who is the product of that kind of culture.
It makes you good at math.
You sit that child down in front of a calculus problem, and they're going to approach it differently. And, you know, some people laugh when I give this theory, but here's the thing. No one has a better theory, right? We don't have any other explanation.
I know.
And the difference between Asian and Western performance is not this much. It's this much. It's enormous, right?
I mean, that's always a good question and a good argument. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. What's the better idea?
Yeah.
And nobody says,
Someone's got to give you a better idea.
Okay.
Okay, well, that was Malcolm Gladwell on the 10,000-hour rule. And nobody's called in on the, what's his name? Kyle Rittenhouse case. If you got any thoughts on that, give us a call. 619-768-2945. This is a big day. Now, in the United States, we're celebrating, or we're observing, rather, that's a better word, observing, Veterans Day. But over in China, it's Singles Day. Singles Day. Singles Day is the largest shopping day of the year on the planet. It dwarfs Black Friday, which we have in this country, which is coming up soon. Let me see if I can get something for you on Singles Day. If you guys got any thoughts on Singles Day, this is a – if you're in the e-commerce, and I got a feeling eventually this is going to be a global holiday. But they're making oh, God knows, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in China right now. It's 11:15. Well, it depends on what part of China you're in. But anyway, Singles Day, let me play something on for you guys that are not aware of it. Huge shopping day. Some of you guys should get in line for it right now.
$14 billion. That's how much Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce giant, made in just 24 hours. That's more than the total online U.S. sales from both Black Friday and Cyber Monday combined. It happened during an unofficial Chinese holiday called Singles Day. But what is Alibaba? What is Singles Day? And how did they make so much money so quickly? Singles Day literally translates to Bear Sticks Holiday, a reference to the Chinese expression bear branches. The expression refers to bachelors who aren't adding branches to the family tree. Now, all of this is rooted in China's one-child policy. Implemented between 1978 and 1980, it was intended to curb the country's overpopulation problem, but the policy had unintended blowback. China now has a massive gender imbalance. By 2020, it's projected that men will outnumber females by at least 30 million, hence Singles Day. From this national turmoil, the unofficial holiday was born at this university. It's a day that was initially meant for single men to party with other single friends. Though, fast forward to 2009, Alibaba CEO Daniel Zhang sees a business opportunity to co-opt the unofficial holiday in an attempt to drum up more online sales. In China, spikes in shopping sales were common in late September before China's National Day, and again in the first 2 months of the year before the Spring Festival. Those two retail polls created a lull in late autumn, which Alibaba hoped to exploit with deep price cuts. And it worked. Seeing the potential of Alibaba's move, most Chinese retailers jumped on board the next year. Now, Singles Day has become the biggest shopping day in the entire world, and it looks like it's just going to get even bigger.
His name is Li Jiaqi, her name is Via. They're top two live streamers of Chinese online shopping apps. These two guys, they made a combined sales of full $100 million in just one day. That's equivalent to the revenue of 10 Macy's stores in a year. This is a new phenomenon in China known as e-commerce live streaming.
E-commerce live streaming started in 2016. In just 3 years, the market is hitting $63 billion this year. That is 6 times the size of U.S. box office revenue.
So today, let's talk about this live streaming in e-commerce. How does it work? Why has it been so successful? And what the future might look like? But before jumping to this topic, I also want to provide some context about e-commerce in China. China has undeniably the largest online retail market in the world.
The market is estimated to reach 1.5 trillion in 2019. That's not just the larger than online markets in the US, UK, Japan, Germany, France, Canada, Korea, Russia, India, Indonesia, Brazil, Argentina. It's larger than the next 10 markets combined.
So despite the enormous size of the market, it is still growing more than 20% every year. And you can imagine the innovations happening in the industry that fuel the growth. And live streaming is definitely one of the drivers in the recent years. So how does it actually look like in real life? Here's a demo. Let's go tap into an e-commerce app. Go to the live streaming section. And you will see many stores doing live streaming. Let's go pick one. So this live streamer, she's trying on her own store design coat. Not only you've got to see how a coat fits into a real person, you can even ask her questions here, and she will respond to you in real time. If you're interested in learning more about the product link is right below. And if you click on that, it will direct you to the product page where you can learn more details, make a purchase, while the live streaming is still on the page. And you can just switch between the product page and live streaming seamlessly. So now the question is, why this format of selling is able to create an industry of 63 billion? I think there are three reasons. Number one, fundamentally, it's adding one element that has been missing in online shopping since its birth, that is human. So think about what information you have when you are shopping at Amazon.com today.
You have text, images, reviews.
Now, live streaming just completely transformed the way you can learn about products online. You basically let a salesperson demonstrate all the possible details about the product in some way not even possible today in physical stores. Like, every time I go to lipstick counters, I wish I could try all the colors. But in reality, I wouldn't try more than three. Now, with live streaming, they just made a dream come true. Check out the guy here. I don't remember how many lipsticks I bought because of his live streaming. It's just so irresistible and compelling. Anyway, let's talk about reason number two, branding ecosystem. In the US, if brands want to do digital marketing, they have to go to Google search or Facebook. Today in China, live streaming in e-commerce has become a norm for marketers. Brands of all kinds you can think of, they have all done live streaming this year. Head & Shoulders, Nestle, Estee Lauder, Adidas, Yves Saint Laurent, you name it. And the more brands participating, the more discount those companies are willing to give away in order to stay competitive, and as a result, more consumers are attracted to watch live streaming. Because more users start to watch live streaming, more brands start to do live streaming. The cycle just goes on and on and on. This year, more than 150 million people have watched live streaming at least once. That's half of the US population. The last reason has to do with technology. When live streaming in e-commerce started 3 years ago, the most traffic only came in the evening when people got connected to Wi-Fi. Now, thanks to the adoption of 4G, people can watch videos at any time, anywhere. This has largely contributed to the increase in traffic. So now the industry has grown to 63 billion, double the size of last year. The question then is, will the momentum continue? My personal observation is yes, also for three reasons. Reason number one, 5G. With the arrival of 5G, it will deliver some of the performance not possible today. For example, how can a brand claim that their product is so effective cleaning your pores while the result is not visually accessible to you online? But that's going to be possible in the future with the video quality empowered by 5G. Reason number two, live streaming will bring more product categories to online shopping. So some product categories are more adopted in online environments than others. Like electronics in China, half of the revenue comes from online today versus categories like car, furniture, jewelry, the penetration is below 10%, which makes sense, right? You do need more visual and experiential information to make purchase decisions, which is exactly what live streaming can offer. Reason number three, live streaming will improve supply chain efficiency and therefore accelerating product selling cycle.
Let's say your store sells handbags. Today the product cycle might look like this. You design, produce, distribute, display, and consumers make orders. From the design to reaching end users, it probably takes 6 months. With live streaming, however, because you can get consumer feedback so fast and get a pretty good estimate of purchase intent, it's possible to go from the design directly to the consumer orders. And this way, not only solves your inventory cost, but also makes you sell more.
With that, I'm pretty optimistic about the future of e-commerce live streaming. Before closing off, I just want to share one last thought.
Chinese online shopping started in 2003 with the launch of Taobao, owned by Alibaba. Now it has 750 million users, more than twice the number of Amazon's users globally. In 2004, first a mobile online payment was introduced, Alipay. Now it has users 1.2 billion, three times the number of Apple Pay's users globally. In 2009, first a shopping festival Singles Day was born, and this year it delivered a whopping 38 billion sales in 24 hours, four times the size of Cyber Monday sales in the US.
While I was doing research about this industry, I actually couldn't find any equivalent in the US market. Do you think that's something applicable to the US market at all? Leave your comments below, let me know. Thank you so much for watching. Next week, I will be talking about 10 moments in China tech of this decade. Stay tuned.
It's said everyone has a story. China has almost 1.4 billion of them. From the mega cities to the vast countryside, from the ancient to modern, it's our job to bring these stories to you, direct from one of the most rapidly changing nations on the planet.
I'm Laura Schmidt, and we're rediscovering China.
Today we're exploring marriage pressure. Its causes, its consequences, and how China's singletons are fighting back. Go on a shopping trip on a Saturday afternoon in downtown Beijing and you might find something unexpected on offer.
报名吗这是？可以现场报名。可以现场报名吗？
你得报上名，然后才能拿那个号码，才可以中奖或者怎么的。The young men and women are making their way to a restricted area in the heart of the building. The details of the latest arrivals flash across a big screen, and the DJ is warming up the turntables. Then there's salsa. Welcome to speed dating, Chinese style.
If you ever needed proof that what China does, it does big, just take a look at this speed dating activity. Over 200 singletons are estimated to show up today and take a shot at finding true love and finding it fast. But this really hasn't been what I expected of a speed dating session. There's been a lot of dancing, a lot of loud music, and a lot of bright lights. Not really the perfect environment to chat and meet new people.
But that doesn't seem to have deterred our eager participants. They are part of the latest wave of singledom. There are currently over 200 million single people of marriageable age in China. That's virtually equivalent to the populations of the UK, Germany, and France put together. This has created a marriage economy, a feature of which is huge speed dating activities like this. In Beijing alone, the organizer, a dating website, holds hundreds of these events every year.
来这里当然为了相亲了。那有没有找到对象啊？没有，特别遗憾。平时工作是职业画家和平面设计师，所以我的工作就特别窄，所以就没有机会接触很多的人，所以就是借这个机会过来看看。当然大家就是参加这种活动的人大多数都比较内向，所以说这种活动也比较不好搞。
In a society where a third of young women admit they prefer watching TV drama series to socializing, and two-thirds of young men confess they'd rather stay at home surfing the internet, the chances of meeting Mr. or Miss Right are obviously limited. And even when they make the effort, full-on physical contact with a total stranger can feel a bit awkward. What these speed dating events set out to do is make people come out of their shell and see if there's a spark.
大家都在说现在单身女生年纪大也没什么不结婚也没什么，但其实内心还是会着急，而且就是有时候突然想到我过完年27岁了，就是不是我不想找，是我真的找不到合适的呀。但毕竟大家都不想一个人过啊。因为这20多年了，连女生手都没牵过，特别着急。然后我爸我妈也每次都催我，他们都说过年的时候找不到女朋友就别回来了。
In China, traditionally the cutoff line for what is considered marriageable age is 25 for men and 23 for women. But times are changing and so-called late marriages are becoming the norm. At the same time, the pressure to seal the deal is growing. Young Chinese are becoming increasingly anxious about being left over.
我们最早的时候，六年前，应该我刚刚接触这一行业的时候，基本上都是适婚年龄，二十七八岁、二十八九岁就觉得很年轻了。但是现在不一样了，现在我们可能有二十二三岁的女孩子，在学校的女孩子还有过来找，要找男朋友，就是年龄越来越低龄化。Zhang
Pengkun is a professional matchmaker with the largest dating website in China. She serves its VIP clients. While professional matchmaking is hardly a new concept in China, through the internet it has experienced a revival as services are moving online. The dating website Ms. Zhang works for claims to have around 200 million users.
哎呀，我一直跟进了一个男会员，终于有消息了，得给他打一个电话。哎，你好，请问是张先生对吗？ 哎，你好，我是百合网的顾问张鹏坤，然后其实有一些您具体的这个情况，我还想多跟您聊聊，可以吗？因为我看您是38岁，1米76的身高，然后是在美国留学回来，目前是一个单身的状态哈，有过婚姻经历吗？嗯。
This kind of one-on-one dating advice is not cheap. The fees start at around $1,500 and can run up to over $7,000. Her clients do not want to reveal their identity, as being single is still considered a sensitive topic in China. And so it's only through talking to Ms. Zhang that we can get an insight into their dating wants and needs.
女孩子希望男人，有责任心，然后最好是事业上有一点小成就。那男人呢，往往都是这样，就是哎，我看中的首先是年轻漂亮，然后相处之后是性格脾气。好，今天要接待的两位会员，男士已经到了，就是这么休闲装就过来了，是吧？<笑>好，来，咱们这边来。 男生坐这边吧，一会儿女孩子有包啊什么的，就放在这边舒服一点啊。然后可能会比较热，脱了外套。
行。
我看看整理一下帅不帅，喝点什么呀，咖啡还是水？
水就行。
行嘞，那等一下啊。好，哎，亲爱的来了。怎么样，路上还堵车吗？
还行，
还可以哈。啊，那个小李啊已经到了
啊。
啊，哎，亲爱的，快过来，两个人认识一下，这是小刘，然后这是李先生，两个人认识一下，握个手吧。已经很长时间就期待这次见面了，那你们俩聊聊啊，然后我先过去。行嘞，好。女孩子更为迫切啊，他们觉得比如说我见了几个人之后还是不可以，那我再去，你快一点快一点给我介绍啊。那男人一般可能会没有那么急迫了，他会觉得说，哦，那好，没有遇到合适的没关系，我现在35岁，我45岁的时候可以照样的找女朋友。
This rush to get married, especially for China's women, is not a new phenomenon. In fact, it has a long history.
那中国很多人都会说，不孝有三哈，无后为大。那么呢，一到了一定特定的年龄，你还没有结婚，还没有要结婚要孩子，那这件事情本身而言，就是父母会觉得面子上过不去。另外呢，还有就是孩子也会觉得，那我孝顺父母啊，我应该是首先要满足他们的心愿，包括也会有这样，就是到您这儿来，我能不能不去考虑结婚啊？但是你是为了就是让我的父母知道我在做这件事情啊，也会有这样的情况。
In the face of this immense pressure to bring home a partner, particularly over Chinese New Year, young Chinese have become incredibly creative in how to appease their parents. One option is to rent a fake boy or girlfriend online. So let's take a look how that works. This website's name translates as rentafriend.com. Their banner says their members offer services including traveling and meeting parents. There's even the possibility of a fake marriage. Users have profiles similar to social media sites and can upload photos, so potential partners can get a good look. Upon registering, I get asked a few rather personal questions, including my height, weight, and body shape. I'm not inclined to be entirely truthful. Signing up is simple enough. Now all I need to do is pick a person to pose as my boyfriend and get in touch. But what do their services actually include? So on one of the biggest forums in the Chinese web, we've discovered this post by a male person who offers their services as a fake boyfriend for Chinese New Year. So as you can see, it's a really detailed post, and services range from going shopping with you for around $3 per hour to watching a movie at just over $1 per hour. He'll also go and see your parents, a little bit more expensive, at just over $7 per hour. And then there is the possibility of getting physical, so you can have a regular kiss for just under $1, fairly inexpensive, or French kissing for just over $1. And then, from what we can tell, there are also more intimate services on offer. So whether this is a fake boyfriend or something else is entirely up to you. While we can't verify how serious that post was, this one seemingly is. We decide to get in touch with the young man advertising himself. He replies within minutes. As I pretend to be a Chinese girl facing marriage pressure, it occurs to me that you never really know who is on the other side of that screen. Is this really a good solution?
I wouldn't say it's probably a changing society. So for the old generation, they have very formulaic type of life, what is good and what is bad, but not the case for the new generation. So therefore, there's quite a lot of conflicts.
OK， 好，我们继续啦。
In 2013, Professor Wong published a book on the economics of love and marriage. He is skeptical of the rent-a-boyfriend business.
I'm not entirely sure I really like that. But if you think that the old generation cannot change and there's no way to communicate, well, why not, right? I mean, it makes life a lot easier for everyone and makes people a lot happier for everyone. However, I think that if I would like to say is maybe it is a good thing to try to get your parents to understand the problem rather than pretending the problem does not exist.
Renting a fake partner is a relatively new concept. A majority of young Chinese still choose to deal with their parents' nagging head on. Fei Wei is one of them. She is from Zhejiang province and works in Shanghai. She has a good degree and a good job. In her free time, she teaches floristry.
这个绣球就是国产的绣球，就只有这个颜色的，对不对？有没有稍微可以放的久一点的？
But none of her achievements seemed to matter the day she turned 25.
25岁之后，我妈只要跟我打电话，说任何事情，她最后可能绕绕绕绕，都会绕到这个啊，为什么还没有找男朋友啊？最近有什么最新情况啊？然后跟大家在一起聊天，聊到我的时候，聊着聊着就回到了这个话题。那个时候我就觉得好像有一点压力了。你妈最近怎样啊？
最近我妈没啥实际行动，但是她会在言语有言语暴力。25岁已经走下坡路了，这是我妈的经典名言。我现在已经是一个就是需要打折才能出售的货。那她怎么把你出售啊？现在看起来这个货也不太好卖，所以我妈最近比较消停。Fei Wei's hometown is just 40 minutes from Shanghai by high-speed train. However, the visits home are no longer a pleasure.
我现在把回家认为就是一个攻坚战，就我现在每次回去，我朋友说你去干嘛了，我都说我跟父母斗智斗勇去了，因为回家的话就可能就变成了全面战争了，就不止我要应付我爸妈，可能还有我爷爷奶奶、外公外婆，那还有我很多亲戚。Fei
Wei's mother is a small-town primary school teacher. Her colleagues and friends frequently ask about her daughter and whether she's still single. So she's merely passing on to her daughter the pressure she faces herself.
Fei Fei is still very young. Why are you so worried about her getting married as soon as possible?
基本上像他那个年龄，在我们这里基本上结婚了，就剩下他一个人还没找对象，特别是他的外公啊、外婆、爷爷奶奶都年纪大的，更要提了。他们是年纪大了，总是盼着这一天，看到他结婚这样子，催嘛是催他的，跟他说的，能够碰到合适的嘛，就是自己主动一点也没关系啊。但是最终还是要他决定。This is Daniel Yen and his girlfriend Wei Tang. Daniel returned to China after completing his studies in the UK and now manages a book cafe in Nanjing. He's 26. He and his girlfriend have been dating half, and now they've decided it's time to tie the knot.
A lot of people say, I think too. I mean, one man can wait. The girls on the other side is just not like that. So my stress mostly comes from my girlfriend.
Well, for China's women, it's the prospect of aging and an idea that this makes them less valuable that creates marriage pressure. For China's men, it's mostly a financial headache.
我这边是比较惨，我大学毕业的时候，我想我说那个叫什么呢？那个反正我当时觉得我肯定是第一个结婚的，结果我到现在我周围的人结都结婚了，就差我一个没结婚。我有一个89年的朋友，现在孩子都3岁。
My girlfriend and her family are quite traditional, you know, like a traditional Chinese family. They wish that the wedding could be like huge or, you know, just like face stuff, right? Like, don't just, they just don't want to lose face. So they're kind of wishing their wedding should be like, amazing.
For Daniel, at the moment, marriage pressure translates into financial pressure. Even though the couple have tried to minimize the cost, they are still looking at a cost of over $20,000 for their wedding. In Chinese culture, it is the norm for the groom's family to pay for the wedding. But Daniel earns less than $1,000 per month, and his father, he won't pitch in. But Daniel's future in-laws still think it's his responsibility as groom to pay.
其实所以我觉得其实在这边其实结婚其实有时候挺没意思的你把什么事情都特别是物质方面的事情掺杂在里面的话我觉得结婚一点意思都没有所以搞得我现在好像都没有什么太想结婚的一些想法了就觉得没有什么激情没有什么激情累得不得了
Nowhere is the pressure on young people to marry more visible than at the Marriage Marketing Park. Here we see the extreme lengths parents are willing to go to in order to escape the embarrassment of an unmarried child.
We're here at People's Square where once again hundreds of people have come to the market. But it's not just any kind of market. There are no properties or items on offer here, but rather actual people. Sons and daughters who are single and whose parents are desperately trying to match them up with the highest bidder. The tension in the air is tangible.
我给你弟弟把女儿的简单情况写写。八三年入住，现在找研发这边。哦。真是麻烦。
Height, age, income, education, household registration. A life's achievement summed up on a sheet of A4 paper pinned to an umbrella. Except the people on offer may not even know they're being advertised like this, and by their parents too, who hide from the cameras for fear of being exposed.
You look at the Renmin Gongyuan in Shanghai, the successful rate is remarkably low, and because I think that China has changed way too much. So it is very difficult for them to understand what their children actually like. So I think that the successful rate is going to be very, very low.
What is the effect of this marriage pressure on the economy, in your opinion?
Well, I think the more the pressure actually coming from too many single men rather than single women, especially you can see that housing prices being one of the chief results of such kind of pressure for men to be able to find a good wife. One of my colleagues have done research in this and find out that this actually has been rather significant effect in pushing up housing prices.
Some people offer a slightly different take on who is affected more by marriage pressure, men or women. One of them is Joy Chen. She wrote a book advising young women in China not to marry before reaching 30. In this, she was encouraging them to fly in the face of the stigma of being a leftover woman, a term coined by the Chinese media almost a decade ago.
From a demographic standpoint, the leftover woman label is completely inaccurate. There are many more leftover men in society than there are leftover women. Yet, this stigma persists. It starts to make women desperate. I mean, I've had women who tell me they're 20 and they're leftover, right? So women start to get very desperate as they near age 30 and say, if I don't marry the next guy who comes along, if I don't grab him and trap him, then it may be too late.
But that, argues Ms. Chen, is a potentially disaster. In her book, she encourages young women to first focus on becoming the person they want to be, to build a career, and most importantly, to wait for the right guy to come along. A marriage sealed in haste, she warns, won't end well.
I've seen studies that say that in Beijing and Shanghai, for people under age 30 who get married, the divorce rate is 60%. So I think it also comes back to a fundamental question about security. You know, I think that that question really goes to the heart of this question of marriage and a basic assumption that marriage will bring you enchengen. In fact, for the majority of young women in some of these big cities, marriage will lead to the exact opposite, which is divorce.
An upsurge in divorces resulted from the so-called first wave of singledom in China's cities. In the 1950s, the country's first marriage law finally enabled women to file for divorce. The 1970s saw a second wave after educated young men and women sent to the countryside from the city under a government policy were allowed to return home. In many cases, they left behind a spouse in the provinces. Then, in the 90s, China's opening up and reform led to a third wave as people questioned traditional family values. This latest wave was kicked off by rapid economic development and the increased independence of Chinese women.
从男交男朋友这个角度来说，我觉得他是一种浪费时间，因为我觉得风险不可控，而且他所要承担的风险非常的高，他没有起到一个对事业的一个加速剂的作用，反而是一个包袱。你是怎么看待我现在的这样一个想法和状态？OK，那这成本回报，你觉得交男朋友有什么成本呢？我觉得成本回报是零的。如果他不能让我的生活锦上添花的话，我觉得人生不需要这一环的。
对啊，如果你觉得没有，那就没有了。但是交男朋友有什么成本呢？没有什么成本吧？有成本啊，时间成本啊，投入啊，包括情感沟通呀，对啊。
那比方说有人陪你去玩呢，如果有一个你很喜欢一起去度假的人，跟你去度假，你开不开心呢？
很开心啊。 然后你刚好在这个很开心的事情时候，也认识了不同的朋友，对吧？这个是坏事吗？ 不是坏事啊，那这个有，这个也没有成本呢， 没有成本， 也没有成本啊，对吧？所以我不见得有成本啊。 长期的维护需要成本。 那你不想维护的话，就不维护喽。如果你刚好认识了很新鲜的东西，然后这很新鲜的东西变成了。